Hello, hello. I'm Bonnie, and thank you so much. My Monday Martinez 12 noon meeting has invited me to come and speak tonight. I'm delighted to be here. If you had told me 12 years ago that you will be in front of this many people at an Al-Anon district meeting telling your story, I would have said NFW. And I thought about that on the way over here, and I thought, you know what, you gotta kind of cool it with some of the things that just come out of you sometime. You know, this is like a, you know, kind of a, you know, they're, for God's sake, they're taping you. But what I want to say is, in the program, I have found peace to be me, and amongst the family that I call my Al-Anon family, I can just be, and it's okay. There's no judgment. You're received as you are when you walk in these rooms. And if you're new to Al-Anon, I will tell you, you have come to the right place. It is an amazing journey to be part of the Al-Anon family. So with that, I would like to say a little bit about my family history. First of all, I am Armenian. And if you don't know what Armenian is, just think Greek and then think with a twist. And how you will know that is by the profile. Oh, that's what Armenian is. I was raised in a very rich culture as a child. My great-grandparents were from the original country, came to America as living survivors of the Armenian genocide, spoke only Armenian when they came, and they made their way to from the East Coast to the West Coast eventually, and my father's family settled in Oakland, and my mother's family stayed in Detroit. And through the years, my family came from Detroit to Oakland. They always gathered around the church because the church was the safe haven for the people. This is where you found your culture. This is where they found their faith. This is where they found the Armenian festivals, the food, the dancing, you know, all of this really rich stuff. And from the time you're like four, or you can stand there, everybody's grabbing hands. And when there's a festival, you're dancing around, whether you're four or you're 400, it doesn't matter. You're part of the group. So that was a really rich heritage to come from. And was very grateful I had that, along with having 14 first cousins. And I can't even count how many second and third cousins. Some of them are my age and they're still second and third cousins. We have one patriarch now that is 92. His name is Uncle Armin to me, but he's actually my second cousin, I think, once removed. I don't know. He was my dad's best friend. They were first cousins. And he still likes to rock and roll dance. And if you get him to an Armenian festival, he'll be up there dancing. So, you know, family, as far as, you know, being grounded in the culture was a wonderful thing for us as kids. I will say my cousins were all very close. We were in Oakland, Piedmont area. We moved to Contra Costa County when I was four. And my other cousins lived like a two blocks away. We all went to the same schools from the time we were elementary all the way through high school. And Pleasant Hill High, and actually closed a few years after the last ones of us got through there, because they'd had enough of us. It was really nice to have, you know, that good close family ties, and we had a lot of fun together as kids. We went to picnics together. We were always at somebody's house on a Sunday afternoon or Sunday evening. We had a aunt that was married to that uncle who's 92, who was Italian. So we had a great mix of Italian and Armenian together. And their house was just fun. I want to tell you, we had more fun like running up the hill in the back and sliding down on our butts. And Auntie was very relaxed with the kids coming and going. She was a stay-at-home mom. My mother was not. She was a working mom. Tell you a little bit about the family there. First with my dad. Dad's personality. Really humorous, loving man, hardworking, always the life of the party as far as inclusive. He was a real loving individual. as kids, my cousins named him Uncle Al, the kiddie's pal. So it was just a wonderful thing to be in his company. The one thing I really was sad with, that being so hardworking and having a business in Oakland, he was a carpet cleaner before there was wall-to-wall rugs and cleaning furniture and all. He wasn't always physically available. He didn't always come home every night. There was only one tunnel at that time going from Oakland to our area. And so he set up shop there. He had a little refrigerator of sorts. Well, probably one of those old refrigerators with the door that opened with the handle like that. And set up a cot. And when he was working late, he just didn't come home. Really missed that because, on the other hand, we had Mom at home, who was a working mom, who was also very dutiful and hardworking. She had a full-time job and did catering on the side. She was a rager. She was very unpredictable. I've surmised that I think she came from a passive alcoholic father and a very demanding mother. She had raised four kids by the time she was 20 years old. In the time of the Depression, she was the oldest. There were four younger kids under her, and she was responsible for them. So probably having another family of three kids that we were wasn't really on her ticket. She was a dutiful student, and she would have done great to go to college and be something studious. But that wasn't in the cards at that time in the 50s. They just got married and had children. So I was the oldest child. I have two younger brothers. We're all 2 years apart. I have a great family. I love my brothers, and they love me, and we are best friends. And I feel that so honored to be able to say that today. They are my father, as far as humor goes. The three of us get together, and I'm in stitches. It's like, you guys, you know, give me a break here. They are, neither one is married, and neither one had children. I was the one who had two children, two sons. The oldest son I'm going to call my first child. And my second son, I'm going to call my second child to keep their anonymity. Neither one of them had children because I think by the time they were done with seeing me run my racket with my kids, they said, no way. In the extended family, I felt stable, loved, appreciated, and understood. In teenage years, with all the cousins and everybody, it's now the 70s, so we're, you know, from 1955 to 1970. And something that is called go find yourself was coming into play in society, and doing your own thing. So in the 70s, all three of these families from Northern California got divorced. One, two, three. So all of us were fragmented with three divorces, and now you have 10 children up here that don't know what's going on. But we had each other, which was really wonderful. I will say that later in life, not too far after that, there was an amends between the parents. So during a holiday time, remember, it's a big party all the time. You're, you know, with the Italians and the Armenians, and there's food and, you know, holidays and whatever. It's like, well, what are you going to do? Leave dad aside? He can't come or whatever? That never happened. There was an unspoken, subtle acceptance of, but you could still come and be part of. They were very individual, and they never did reconnect, any of them. But they respected each other, and I loved that. It was very healing for us as kids. So I'm about 18 years old, and it's time to go to school or whatever. I tried DVC for a while. I really wasn't a student because being raised in a family with such instability at home, and it was so scary, I couldn't focus on anything. In school, I was a miserable student. I really did good in homemaking. I got an home ec award on awards night in high school, senior. They said, you got to come to the awards night. I'm looking at them and, me at an awards night? Now the teacher said, you got to come. Okay, I'll come. And she presented this award for being the highest honored student in the home ec department. Gave me a set of sterling silverware. in front of all these people, like as many as you. Well, I did what any kid at that age who didn't think they were deserving did, and that was cried and walked off the stage. I still have the silverware, though. So went to beauty school. Finally, I tried a few other things, but that wasn't working out. But I always was playing with the cousin's hair. I was a girl. I had two brothers. They wouldn't let me play with their hair. But the girls did, and I was always ratting and doing all this. And one time, my lovely Italian auntie says to me, Bonnie, why don't you go to beauty school, honey? You always like doing hair, and you're always good with that. And maybe it'd be good they always said this then. Maybe it'll be good something you can always fall back on. I thought, well, I'll go check that out. So I checked it out, and that was a good fit. They had a scholarship program going. It cost virtually nothing to go. You could get it done in 10 months, and I thought, well, I have no other path here. I don't see. Let's go give that a try. So did that, found my first job, and successfully launched myself out of the house at the age of 19. Hallelujah. I married my first love, who was my first official qualifier. I didn't know that my mom really qualified me, and she had no idea through her whole life that she ever did. As time went on and she got older and mellowed out some, I became not responsible for us because we now are growing up and getting on with our life, and she was only working one job at that time. She started to settle and could be trusted a little bit more. I married my ex, I'll call him. We went to a program that his stepfather was going to, and so he's going into a alcohol and rehab program. And I'm hearing, you know, they're giving a lecture and they want everybody in the family involved and whatever. And everything they're saying there at this lecture about rehab, I'm thinking, and about what you're living with as an alcoholic family, I'm thinking, Jiminy Christmas, that's me. What the hell? There's no alcohol visible that I've ever seen in my family. And my ex was, you know, occasionally drinking on the weekends, but not drinking stumbling drunk. There was other addiction going on there with methamphetamine and all, that I was so naive to that. I had no idea that would affect and that you would get the behaviors that you get with living in an alcoholic family. So, you know, his behaviors were physically and emotionally abandoned. He could not show up emotionally. He was a veteran from the Vietnam War. He was sarcastic and belittling, harsh with the kids. We had one at that time. Of course, my behaviors would be demanding and successful, business-oriented, take charge, know-it-all. Oh, my God, I knew it all for me. I knew it all for you and anybody else that you might know. I will not charge, but I will tell you the way it should be. Fucking really? No wonder you're so damn tired. Codependent to the... I read Codependent No More at the time. That was popular. It was like, they wrote that book for me. I was also resentful, critical, and exhausted. My first child was born. He was an inconsolable child. I had a very traumatic birth experience. And also, by the time he was just a couple months old, not even a couple months, probably 6 weeks old, they had him on phenobarbital. Father was using. I was on Bendectin, which was for morning sickness, a severe morning sickness. So that was in my system. We didn't know anything about drugs or whatever. They told you not to smoke and not to drink, and I didn't do any of that. I was a goody two-shoes, just sticky two-shoes. It was sickening. But here we have this little guy who comes into our life, and what do you do with him? I can't do anything unless I'm holding him, rocking him, walking him in the car. I'd put him in the car seat, drive him around the block, take him in the stroller, whatever, something to comfort this child. And luckily, even though my mother wasn't very comforting emotionally with me, there was something instinctively that I knew about this baby or babies. You know, I did babysit and all that kind of stuff. And I could always comfort him by holding him or taking his little face in my hands and holding him, making eye contact and all. So the first 4 years were up and down and all around. I don't know how many daycares told us you're no longer, we don't have a spot for you as of today. It was time to like look into really kindergarten. And I'm thinking, this is just insane. I can't keep him in daycare. He's in unpredictable. What do we do? So one of my lovely clients who worked for the school district told me that you need to go see the school district and tell them about your son. And I think they can help you. Well, she knew about special ed. I didn't know anything about anything special ed. So went and talked to them. The lady was so wonderful. She goes, Bonnie, I can help you. I just sat there and cried. I thought, oh my God, there really is an answer here. The first thing that happened with him, because at that time he was so out of control, they did put him in a residential hospital for young babies, or, you know, young kids, that it doesn't exist anymore, but it was here in Walnut Creek. They kept him for a while, and during that time, the assessment and all showed that he would be a good candidate for residential care, meaning they take the child out of the home and place them in a group home, and they do extensive therapy and all. Well, I knew at that time that what we had been doing for almost 5 years and all the different therapy and all wasn't working, that I had to love him enough to let him go and see if we can, as a group, parents and the support of the school district, be able to help him, because I was really afraid that maybe this wouldn't ever turn around. You know, I will say that in his growing up years, before he got into using himself, which was a preteen, he started drinking, and then he got heavy into drugs. You know, his behavior was really, really aggressive and dangerous to himself and others, and especially to my second child. So I knew that I could not do. I couldn't lose two of them over not knowing what to do with one of them. Yeah, got to do something here. This just doesn't fit. So I went home and I convinced my ex that we're going to go find out, you know, get him into this residential program. And he just like kind of gave it up, because he was in his own addiction at the time. I was too busy spinning, working, and taking care of these two that I just made that decision. And then he was accepted, so it was the right thing. The things that I did during that time, I was praying incessantly. Very lucky that when I was a child, I had a Sunday school teacher. All of the church thing, by the way, was very dogmatic, and it didn't make any heart connection for me. My connection was with nature, with music, and with people that I knew loved me unconditionally. All those aunties that were out there, the neighbor that was home with her kids that, you know, we became friends, those people loved me and mothered me without even knowing it in a healthy way. So I prayed a lot. I was still fearful and worrying, but it wasn't the first thing. The first thing I did was give it to God and give him to God. I wanted to keep the connection with him, show up for anything that necessary when he was in residential or the hospital. The short meetings or visits, I always showed up. And while we were still married, my ex always showed up. We drove miles and miles, I mean, 3-hour drives for like a 1-hour visit, if he was cooperating that day. So, and home visits when it was possible. He wasn't always in a place emotionally to come home, even though he wanted to come home, but you just couldn't do that. It wasn't safe. So I will say I was introduced to my, that's coming later, but I was introduced to the Promises recently by my lovely friend and sponsor. And I didn't know anything about the Promises. So when you're in this program and, you know, it's like, oh, okay, I don't wanna, and you think you kind of got, you know, all the literature and you've heard stories all before, there's always a surprise. So the Promises were introduced 3 weeks ago, and I'm writing out my speech here, what I'm going to say, and try to keep my ADD at bay. And so after I'm telling you about things that I did, the first thing I wrote was Promise 1. We will love others without losing ourselves, and we will learn to accept love in return. I needed to learn how to love my child without losing myself. And I didn't know what that meant at the time, but it's in print, and I now know through the program and the work that has been done in the program and that I've done with my sponsors, that I can feel very much that this is a true statement for me. And the Sunday school teacher at 12 years old or so said to me, she was the only one that made sense, because she wasn't of the dogma of the just ritual. She said, "Bonnie," she said, "God loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life." I was like, really? Such a small little sentence, she said. And I thought, I like that. That seems like a God of my understanding. I'm going to take that pearl and I'm going to put it in my pocket. And I never left that my whole life. It's always been there, the gift that she gave me, helping me believe that that could be true. So the other thing that I heard during these early years with my son in the residential care placements, by the way, there were 7 of them. So he did well and then he didn't. And then they would send him home. Or they, when he, by the time he was 16, they were sending him to juvenile hall, because they don't know what to do with kids like this. And having him home again wasn't safe. I tried everything and I was very determined. I'm a very determined woman. I like to get things done. And I will listen and I will follow instructions. I will do what you're saying will work, even if it is hard for me. I'll get the support I need around me and let's have that happen. But the other thing I heard was, I heard God talking. I'm telling you, I didn't ever really hear God. Didn't talk me, didn't text me or whatever, but I heard. And this is when my marriage is ending, and now we don't have an active father because he's emotionally checked out. But he's also not part of the problem. We're not living with this anymore. I took my youngster, my firstborn, and got the hell out of there with help of friends and family, got myself to a safe place. And my message from God was, "Bonnie, you be his mother, and I'll be his father." So I thought, pearl right there, and it's a help that helped a lot. So we get divorced, and there's a small child support payment back then. This is a long time ago, kids. I got like $200 for 2 kids a month. I'm a hairstylist, 1 income, and it's like, oh, how are we going to do this? Well, again, HP is going, "I got this for you, kid. Don't worry about it. I'll start blessing you with rebate checks that come in from your whatever overpayment of this or that. Free tutoring. Your youngest needs tutoring. He's having a really hard time in school and with reading. So we'll just have a whole reading program tell you that it's paid for. You get him there and we'll take care of him." For about 3 years, every week he was there. Had that, tax refunds came in. Blessings just upon blessings financially. And it got to the point where something would come in the mail and I didn't recognize it. I'd open it up and I'd just start chuckling. I'm thinking, God, really? It's another, like, I don't know, anywhere from $200 to $800, $1,000 rebate or whatever check would come. So we never were without. We were being cared for all the time. I'm not saying that I didn't work. I worked my ass off, really. But I also was in the company of a loving clientele that loved me. Prayer warriors, I will say. These people, these women, really believed in prayer. I even had one bring me a prayer plant one time. My dear little Betty, she's no longer with me. She's been gone probably about 10, 12 years. But 15 years ago, she brought this prayer plant in. She goes, "Bon, I think you need a few more prayers, honey." She gave me the plant. It was one of these little things that you get at Safeway or whatever, right? And I thought, oh, Betty, don't bring me a prayer plant. I'm terrible even with silk plants. But it was like she's giving me, I feel so bad because I know I'm not going to make this thing work. It was in a small pot. What do I know? I left it in a small pot until it had 3 leaves left on it. And I'm thinking, don't tell Betty, you're killing the prayer plant. What happens with all those prayers? You know, later I figured it out and put it in a bigger pot. That plant is still alive today. I wish I could show you a picture. It is this big. And Betty's no longer here with me, but she's still praying for us. So the family support was amazing. Even my mother came around. She you know, when I had the kids, I kind of just told her, there's a certain way we're going to treat these children. And if you want to be part of their life, you're going to treat them this way and accordingly. And if I find that it's different than that, you won't have that ability, because they have to be in a safe place and feel very loved. But there's something different that happened. Right? She'd already raised a family when she was 20 years old, raised those younger kids. And then she had us, and basically we raised ourselves, or I was the boss, right? So I took care of that. But when she became the grandmother, oh my God, it was like the best title she could ever have. And then I became the mother. So we had grandma and we had mom, and there was no more conflict with that. And then, you know, everybody's love is going to the kids. So that was a really wonderful blessing. So here we are, and I'm divorced now, and I'm in my 40s, and I'm really thinking I don't want to be alone the rest of my life, so we'll start dating. And I dated quite a bit. And after my third alcoholic boyfriend, all wonderful men, all, you know, gregarious, some of them ethnic, they could cook, we danced, we just had a hell of a good time. And they were definitely not good for me. So when I finally came to terms with that, and that took a couple of years, it was like, okay. I was meant to tell you that in Byron's care, they also offered family therapy. So I got my own therapist, which I stayed with for 10 years. And she, during that time, told me, you know, Monty, Al-Anon could really help you. And I'd heard a little bit about Al-Anon when my stepfather was in the program, too. And it was like, I went to 3 meetings, and I thought, I'm not like all those people. Those people are really, there's really shit going on there. And these people never graduate. They're 10, 20, 35. I'm thinking, oh my God, this can't possibly work. So big ego, new to all, whatever. So finally in 2006, I go to my first Al-Anon meeting. And I am broken by now. I'm gone through a divorce. What happened to my Beaver Cleaver family that I was going to have? I mean, that's what I was about. I was going to stay married forever and ever. We were going to be successful at our love for each other and, you know, raise our children. And maybe even have one of those stickers that said, proud parent of a middle school honor student. You know, how many years I hated those people for putting those on. Are you kidding? I want to be a proud parent with doesn't have a kid in juvenile hall. God. So here we are with promise two. We go to first Al-Anon meeting, and this is what I did for exactly 6 months or more. I went there, I listened and learned, because those were our slogans, and I cried. Just wept. I was in a place of just being broken. And there was nothing more I could say. I sat at the back of the room, couldn't sit at the front. I'm a mess, right? And but this is where I meet my first wonderful sponsor, who took me by the hand and sat next to me every time. And she at that time had 30 plus years in program. But I thought, you know what? She's not weird or anything. And 30 years, something must be working. This woman keeps coming to these meetings. She seems joyful. She seems to have that thing called serenity, which I had no idea for many years in program what that really meant. It was like, what? Serenity? Well, maybe they give that to you like one of those chips one of these days. I was so confused. But what I do want to say is promise, one of the promises, so going to the meetings, now I can look back and say, we will begin to feel and will come to know the vastness of our emotions, but we will not be slaves to them. That was huge for me. I needed to be in touch with my grief. All these things that hadn't worked the way I had hoped they would. Very grateful for my first sponsor who worked the first 3 steps with me. 3 steps. A year and a half plus. What? Okay, why would that be? Well, maybe because we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. Well, that would be for some of you, but I certainly wasn't in an unmanageable situation, was it? Could it be? Yeah, it was so unmanageable. And I had such a hell of a time admitting it. You'd think after all of that and therapist and everything else and going through a divorce and dating alcoholics and having a kid in residential care that you'd admit that maybe you are pretty powerless and your fucking life is unmanageable. So I wish my sponsor just keeps working those three steps. The second one, of course, this is for newcomers, I guess. The rest of you could say it with me. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity, which I really needed to be restored to sanity. Not that I didn't believe there was a power greater than myself. I knew there was. I'd seen miracles in my life, even since a child. We lived to adulthood in my house, so I knew there were miracles. Sorry, Mom. You know, made a decision to turn my will and my life. And I always, you know, I personalize this because it doesn't mean nothing to me unless I make it about me. Because I have to admit these things and I have to be at a place where my ego isn't driving me and that I can actually receive the gifts of the program this way. So I say, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. And praying only for his will for me and the power to carry that out. I have to do that daily. This isn't a one-shot deal. This wasn't doing my steps and just finishing it up. We're in three, let's go to four, whatever. This thing I have to do every day. I have to make a decision to turn my will over so God can have some part in what goes on in my life that actually might bring me serenity. So yeah, it took a year and a half to do that step work with that sponsor. I will be eternally grateful to her. She is one of my very best friends ever. I really believe that she was one of the first people that I could honestly be intimate about all areas of my life, and that had not happened in my life before. Her wonderful words to me, and still I hear this and will hear it for the rest of my life, you're going to be just fine. I was in awe of the feeling that that could be true, but I knew she believed it, so if she believed it, I would believe it. And I'm always and will always be grateful to her for that. So here we have a year and a half doing one, two, and three. Then I take a little break from step work. I'm exhausted by now. It's like by the time I finally got this, and it's starting to sink in. I started to think maybe, and I wasn't crying all over the place anymore. I could do some service work. They need share people at the meetings or a treasury spot or helping out with the Day in Al-Anon. If none of you have ever done any service at the Day in Al-Anon, it's a great place to get connected. If you're shy and you know you don't really want a whole lot of responsibility, I was kind of detached, you know. I didn't want to get too close because I was really vulnerable and didn't know how to have that inner strength there. Went to Day in Al-Anon, helped out in the kitchen with a lovely crew of people that I will always be grateful for. Had so much fun doing the breakfast crew and helping when people were bringing stuff. And did that a couple of years. It was a great way to get started in doing some service. Did lots of meetings during that time when I was not doing any more step work. And the thing that was really important, I kept coming back. And I kept coming back because people had their butts in the chairs, just like you guys, that kept coming back. That was just incredible to me and so healing to me. So this is not a class. I'm not a teacher, really. I'm a hairdresser. The part of the program after a while became really important to me and that I was still kind of stumbling around with was that I didn't get this thing of forgiveness. And I'd have people in my life other than just my mother. I was sexually molested by two non-family members, but both had authority over me. One was a visiting priest to my grandparents' home and a fifth grade school teacher. And nothing was done about either one of those. So I held resentment over them for years and years. I absolutely held a resentment for my ex-husband, especially financially, because he left me in a loop with that. Even though God was blessing, it was like, where are you? You know, went off and got married for the third time and had very little contact with the kids. So what I will say is I had to get real about forgiveness. So my little Courage to Change, my first little book that I had, I get to October 15th, and it says, the most loving form of detachment I have found has been forgiveness. instead of thinking of it as an eraser to wipe another's slate clean, or a gavel to pound and pronounce somebody not guilty, I think of forgiveness as a scissor. I use it to cut the strings of resentment that bind me to the problem or the past. By releasing resentment, I set myself free. So I thought it was time to cut. 10, great. It was a process. I can't tell you that that happened overnight, but I knew that carrying that baggage or not being able to, first of all, I knew that those things I never deserved. So it wasn't that I was saying it never happened or it was okay. It's okay that you beat the shit out of us or whatever. It wasn't okay. And it wasn't okay that I was assaulted as a child. It wasn't okay that Dad didn't show up when I needed him. That wasn't okay either. But all of it was of the past, and I needed to have a clean slate to be able to move forward and to be happy, joyous, and free, because that's what the program says, happy, joyous, and free. So get back to step work with my second sponsor. We did Pastor Recovery. During Pastor Recovery, I did the Pastor Recovery, and I did a searching and fearless moral inventory, step 4. Most amazing part about that was I thought after all these years in therapy that I would have really had this under control, but I found myself a thread that connected me with all parts of my life, comforted by my HP, higher power, which I call God, understanding and healing my fears and my past. So did all 12 steps. It felt that took about a year and a half, I think. But again, I was told there's no timeline. That was so good. I was always under pressure thinking that things had to happen a certain way and in a certain time. My son, who did end up as an addict alcoholic, ended up in all of the prison situations that he could possibly get into. He was really curious, I guess. From going through juvenile hall, then you go to county jail. These are for not nonviolent offenses. I mean, he's not packing a gun, and he didn't kill anybody, but he did enough stuff in the community and society that he was a menace. So they locked him up. I went to the parole board. I'm petitioning for more residential care, get him out of the jail and into some more recovery. They listened a few times, and then he got himself, and what happens is when you're finally in a place where they don't know where you're going to be or how long they're going to keep you, they put you in San Quentin. So there's a lot of people in San, there's more than the 8,000 inmates at San Quentin, and a lot of them are nonviolent offenders that are there because then from there, that's the housing place that they're going to send them here, there, and everywhere. So that's where they hold them. So I've got a kid at 20 years old in San Quentin. Just saying the word just gave me shivers. So the parole board's gonna do a parole on him. They wanna hear from mother. Mother's gonna go to San Quentin and petition for this kid's release. Well, I said to myself, this is the scariest thing I've ever done, more than any of the other institutions. And I'm going on my own, by myself. You walk through the gates. First of all, they strip search you practically. And you walk through the gates and you're walking down a little hallway to get to the meeting place. And I see, you know, guys working in the yard. These are inmates, right? And there's guys in the tower with the, I mean, I see the damn automatic white rifle, whatever. I'm scared out of my mind. And I said to myself going there, I would be, you know, dutiful and do this and hope that the parole board would do something in his behalf. But I will not do it again. I'm only going to do this once. And if he's not going to get it from there, I don't know what else I can do, because it has to be his willingness that's going to make a change in his life. So while he's at San Quentin, God sends the messenger. What? The messenger is one of the cellmates, and the cellmate says to him, "Hey, kid, what are you doing in here? You're so young. You have choices. You have your life ahead of you. You got to get the hell out of here and make something of your life." And my very defiant, know-it-all kid, who's a big, you know, bully, whatever kind of guy, he heard this guy's message. Oh, by the way, that guy was 30 years old and is a lifer and never getting out. There was a message. So he did come out of San Quentin. He did decide that he wasn't going to do that part again, and he was there for a long enough time that it was really scared the hell out of him. And he said, Mom, I'm not ever going back. So from that point, he did adopt a program, work with a sponsor, has gotten his life together. He is now 36 years old. He is a dutifully working man, taking care of a family, and running an honest program, and he is my living miracle. Thank you. So I'm gonna close with this. I have to tell you a little bit more, but so promises. One of the promises said, "No longer terrified, we will discover we are free to delight in life's paradox, mystery, and awe." I feel so blessed to tell you I am a happy, grateful Al-Anon lifer, that I will never graduate, that I'm so grateful for these rooms and all the people that come and share their stories and keep coming back, that miracles happen. I believe when we change, things around us change, that there is hope for everyone in every situation. So, by the way, I made amends with my ex. And he offered, if he could be, I was making a move that he instituted. He found the place, the perfect place, single-story home, affordable, in the Contra Costa area, and said, if you'll trade Byron, at that time he was, my number one son, my first child, if you'll trade him in for me as your roommate, I will take care of all the finances of living there. So the man who never paid any damn money after the first 2 years is now paying all the money, and he cooks and gardens, ladies. We are not romantically involved. I'm in a different zone there with him. I do wear a wedding ring, but it's my mother's wedding ring that I had redone for me after she was gone 20 years. I thought it was time, and I finally found it after I lost it for a few years. So I wear a ring that is my ring from Mom. And I have an amends with a man who is living a kind and loving way with somebody that he respects, and I can respect him for that. So thank you so much for letting me share. Thank you for coming and being part of the Al-Anon family. We are so all blessed to have this wonderful program. Thank you.